Tonight on PBS News Weekend, families reunite as more Israeli hostages and Palestinian prisoners are released on day three of the temporary ceasefire. Then my conversation with children's book author Linda Piston, who at 11 years old already has her sights set on teaching young girls science and going to Mars.
I always loved chemistry, and then I also loved physics and mathematics and astronomy. Once I heard about astrophysics, I realized, wait, hold on, this is actually the perfect option because I can get everything I love into one thing.
And the story of Mary Golda Ross, the first Native American woman to become an engineer. Good evening, I'm John Yang. Two Americans, including a four-year-old girl, were among the 17 hostages Hamas released today for the third exchange for Palestinians in Israeli prisons. 14 Israelis and a Russian citizen were also among those released in return for 39 Palestinian prisoners. Meanwhile, Hamas said four of its senior militants have been killed in the war so far, including the commander for northern Gaza. He's the highest-ranking known casualty. And late today, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu seemed to open the door to the possibility of more pauses in fighting if Hamas releases more hostages. That could mean more reunions for both Israelis and Palestinians.
This weekend in Israel and on the West Bank, joyous celebrations. Four-year-old Abigail Idan, who holds both U.S. and Israeli citizenship, was the youngest hostage released today. Both her parents were killed October 7th. President Biden noted that she had turned four just 2 days ago.
She spent her birthday, that birthday, and at least 50 days before that, held hostage by Hamas. Today, she's free. More is needed, but this deal is delivering life-saving results. Critically needed aid is going in, and hostages are coming out.
The pause in fighting is also allowing trucks loaded with food, water, and other crucial supplies to cross into Gaza and head north, where for weeks residents have suffered without aid. In southern Gaza, near Khan Yunis, residents picked through the rubble of their homes.
This feeling is one I cannot describe. My family and I cried when we saw the house destroyed. It destroyed my heart, my whole life.
But the pause is only temporary, as Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu underscored today while visiting Israeli troops in Gaza.
We have three goals in this war. Eliminate Hamas, return all of our hostages, and ensure that Gaza does not return to be a threat to the state of Israel again.
But Israeli troops appear to still be carrying out missions in Gaza. The Red Crescent Society said a Palestinian farmer was killed in a targeted Israeli attack. And on the West Bank, not included in the temporary ceasefire, violence intensified. In the Jenin refugee camp, Israeli troops killed five Palestinians as they tried to arrest a murder suspect. The Palestinian Health Ministry said three others were killed this weekend in separate incidents.
A tanker with links to Israel was seized today in the Gulf of Aden off Yemen's coast. The vessel is carrying a full cargo of phosphoric acid and a multinational crew of 22. No groups claimed responsibility, but it's at least the third maritime attack in recent days that's been linked to the Israel-Hamas war. Three young men of Palestinian descent were shot last evening as they walked to dinner in Burlington, Vermont. All three graduated from the same high school in the West Bank and are now in American colleges. Burlington police say a white male with a handgun confronted them. Arab anti-discrimination groups say they were chatting in Arabic and wearing keffiyehs. The Palestinian Foreign Ministry condemned the shootings and called on U.S. authorities to hold those responsible to account. A powerful winter storm swept through parts of Eastern Europe today, knocking out power and closing roads. A large part of Bulgaria is under a state of emergency, and the Odessa region of war-weary Ukraine is also being hit hard by the winter weather. Still to come on PBS News Weekend, an 11-year-old trying to change the world through astrophysics, mealworms, and teaching other young girls. And the life and legacy of the first Native American woman to become an engineer.
This is PBS News Weekend. From WETA Studios in Washington, home of the PBS NewsHour, weeknights on PBS.
A decades-long Harvard study has concluded that the key to lifelong health and happiness is good relationships. Ali Rogan has more on what you can do to nurture the relationships in your life.
We've long heard about the importance of diet, exercise, and good genetics to long-term health. But the longest-running study on living a longer, satisfying life shows that your relationships are just as important. The Harvard Study of Adult Development found that close friendships, more than money, fame, or even your cholesterol level, are connected to keeping people happy and healthy in the long term. With the holiday season upon us, it's an opportunity to connect with loved ones, but it can also be a lonely time. To walk us through some of his decades of research on human joy is Dr. Robert Waldinger, professor of psychiatry at Harvard Medical School and the director of the Harvard Study. His latest book, The Good Life, Lessons from the World's Longest Scientific Study of Happiness, came out this year. Dr. Waldinger, thank you so much for being here with us. What does your study show about the role of relationships and friendships in human health and happiness?
What we found is that relationships actually protect us. They protect our health as well as our happiness. They get into our bodies and they actually keep us from getting the diseases of aging as early, and they help us live longer.
What are some of the physiological effects of that? How does it get reflected in our bodies?
It seems to have to do with stress, that relationships help us weather the stresses that are normal in our lives, right? So that if something happens to me today that's upsetting, I can go home and call somebody, or I can talk to my partner, and I can literally feel my body calm down. And we think that it's partly that calming effect when we're stressed that protects us from the ravages of, you know, of time.
And what types of relationships are important?
It's all types of relationships. What we find is that everybody needs somebody who they feel really has their back, that they could go to in times of need. But then beyond that, it could be friends, work relationships, even casual relationships. The person who checks you out in the grocery store, if you have a friendly conversation with that person, you get a little hit of well-being.
And what are your recommendations for somebody who's taking stock of where they're at in terms of their relationships and says, I need to make changes? What do you recommend people do?
Well, if it's a relationship you already have, there are things we can do to strengthen those relationships. So reaching out often, like just sending somebody a text or an email or calling them on the phone, just saying, hi, I just wanted to connect. But then if we want more relationships, if we don't have enough in our life, one of the best ways to do that is to do something you love or something you care about alongside other people. So it could be volunteering for a community organization. It could be a gardening club or a soccer league. Because what we find is that when we're with the same people over and over again, who are at first strangers, we're doing something we all love. And so we have something in common, and that's a natural place to start conversations. Then some of those conversations can deepen into friendships.
The holiday season can be a wonderful time full of friends and good cheer, but it can also be a stressful time. Things like planning for travel and hosting big groups. What are your recommendations for people looking to stay present once they're with the people that they love?
You know, one of my teachers once said, attention is the most basic form of love. Mm-hmm. That if you can, in all the hustle and bustle of the holidays, actually spend time just being with somebody, just being with your family, that goes a long way. And that gives a gift that only you can give to somebody else. Now, it's hard to do, but we can structure our holiday gatherings so that we have a little time to take a walk with that person who we want to be sure we connect with during the holidays.
And on the flip side of that, certainly many people are spending the holiday season with people that they don't see as being a nurturing part of their circle, their village. What are your tips for how to approach those relationships?
Different ways. So first, you can bring curiosity even to that person who really annoys you. One question you can ask yourself is, okay, I'm with this person who I don't like being with. What's here that I've never noticed before about this person? And being curious about somebody goes a long way to making them feel seen and making them feel like you're interested in them. And even the most annoying people will respond warmly, usually, to your genuine curiosity. So try bringing some curiosity to an old, annoying relationship.
Dr. Robert Waldinger with Harvard Medical School, thank you so much for your time.
It was a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Five years ago, Linda Piston set out to achieve two goals in her life: end world hunger and improve science education in public schools. To that end, she took classes at the University of Virginia this summer. And in August, she added to her accomplishments by becoming a published author. All this at the age of 11. Linda Piston joins us now. Linda, I want to talk about your book in a little bit, but first I want to talk a little bit more about you. You live in Northern Virginia, just outside Washington. You were studying Chinese this summer, is that right, at the University of Virginia?
Yes.
You've done a lot of things a lot of 10-year-olds haven't done. Have you always done things, you always remember doing things that other kids your age might not necessarily be doing?
Well, most 10-year-olds haven't published a book, and also most 5-year-olds haven't started a business at that point, and I actually taught myself to read when I was just 4.
You started a business when you were 5?
Yes, my business is called Linda's Lab, and it has two main goals: one, to solve world hunger, and the other one, to improve science education in schools.
And how do you do those things?
Well, I am solving world hunger through mealworm protein, because I turn the mealworms into a protein powder that I can then put into protein bars. And once I make them shelf stable by working with a production company, I can distribute them worldwide. And I also have the larva library, which lends mealworm tanks to schools so that classrooms can see the life cycle. I just love to teach people about science through my social media, and I also am doing it through my free read-alouds that I do in classrooms and schools.
I know you've said that you want to be an undergraduate at UVA by the time you're 14, and you want to study astrophysics.
Yes.
How did you get interested in astrophysics?
I always loved chemistry, and then I also love physics and mathematics and astronomy, and all those things combined is astrophysics. So for years I was searching for like which one I liked the most. Once I heard about astrophysics, I realized, wait, hold on, this is actually the perfect option because I can get everything I love into one thing. So now I love to do astrophysics experiments. I love to go out to the Dark Sky Park near me, Sky Meadow State Park. And I love to look at the night sky when they have like a special night where everybody brings down their telescopes and they do a presentation.
We should also point out that not only have you been taking classes at the University of Virginia, but you go at 11 to a high school, to a science high school.
Yes.
An elementary school. What grades did you skip?
I skipped 1st, 3rd, and 5th grade.
After you graduate from University of Virginia with your degree in astrophysics, you want to go to Caltech.
Yes.
And work for NASA. And what do you want to do for NASA?
So I want to be an astrophysicist. And so for NASA, I want to work at the Jet Propulsion Lab at Caltech. I would also love to be the first person to go to Mars. And I feel like it could be very valuable. And maybe even bring mealworms to space, because mealworms can be used to solve many world problems. And I'm just kind of curious to see how they can live in space in zero gravity.
Let's turn to your book now. It's called Linda and the Mysterious Footprints.
Yes.
Tell me, how did you get this idea and how did you decide to write a book about it?
So when I was 6, I was studying carbon emissions, like all 6-year-olds do. And I heard the term carbon footprint. And I thought it was really funny because I was picturing actual footprints. And so that small picture helped me understand a really big idea. So I wrote it down. And I made myself the main character because I wanted to live in a world where a little girl scientist can see a problem and be respected and heard. That is the world I want to live in.
I think you're living in it, quite frankly. Linda, in the book, actually sees black footprints.
Yes.
And tries to figure out what's going on.
Yeah.
And how does she do that? What's the technique or the method she uses to do that?
So she uses the scientific method, which in my opinion is one of the most important parts of all of STEM. The scientific method, basically, it's used for when people do experiments. First, you ask a question, then you research, then you form a hypothesis. And the hypotheses are very important because also it can show you how you can learn from if you make a mistake. It can help you with future things when you might not be able to test it, because some of parts about science are just us making educated guesses, and that's basically what a hypothesis is. And so then you experiment, and then you form a conclusion.
So all these things that you do, all these accomplishments you've had, going to high school, going to UVA, but still you're an 11-year-old girl. What do you do in your spare time? What do you like to do when you're not doing all these things?
So I love to be outdoors. I love to go camping with my scout troop, but I also love taking care of my business, Linda's Lab, and that takes up a lot of my free time, but it's one of the most fun things I do.
I understand you have two brothers who are also pretty smart, right?
Yes.
Is there a little rivalry?
Occasionally. My mom likes to say, me and my little brother, Thomas, who's 6 years old, are so similar. We both want to go and be the first person on Mars. So
you're racing to see who's going to get there.
Basically. And so it's going to be definitely interesting to see which one of us gets on Mars first. I'm definitely hoping it's going to be me.
So. Last question I want to ask you is that I understand your name, Linda, is very special in your family. Tell us about that.
So my grandmother was named Linda, like me. My mom tells me she was really nice. She was unfortunately killed by the DC snipers before I was born, so I never actually got to meet her. But she was a math and science teacher and loved math and science, just like me.
And she'd probably be very excited and very proud of what you're doing now.
Yes.
Linda Piston, thank you very much.
You're welcome. So nice to meet you.
Good to meet you. Thank you very much. As Native American Heritage Month draws to a close this week, we look at the life and legacy of the nation's first female Native American engineer. That's tonight's Hidden Histories. Mary Golder Ross was a pioneering figure of the space age, the first Native American woman to be an engineer. Achievements she attributed to the Cherokee emphasis on education and on educating boys and girls equally. She was born in 1908 in Park Hill, Oklahoma, to a family with a proud Cherokee heritage. Her great-great-grandfather, John Ross, was chief of the Cherokee Nation during the turbulent and traumatic era of the Indian Removal Act of 1830. Thousands of Cherokee people were forced to leave their ancestral lands in the American Southeast and walk to Indian Territory in what is now Oklahoma, a route known as the Trail of Tears. As a child, Ross was sent to live with her grandparents in Tahlequah, Oklahoma, the one-time capital of the Cherokee Nation, so she could attend school. After high school, Ross earned a math degree from Northeastern State Teachers College in Tahlequah, the successor to the Cherokee Female Seminary, which her great-great-grandfather had helped establish. Ross taught math and science in Cherokee schools in Oklahoma and was assigned to the government-run Santa Fe Indian School in New Mexico. She was a girls' advisor at the boarding school, a Native American role model for Indian girls separated from their parents and families.
You cannot understate her passion for teaching others, to talking to other Indian kids about science, technology, engineering, and math.
During breaks, Ross took enough classes to earn a master's degree in math in 1938 from what is now the University of Northern Colorado. At the time, academic and industrial labs employed few women. Teaching was one of the only careers in which a woman like Ross, trained in math or sciences, could use their knowledge to earn a living. But during World War II, as industry geared up for wartime production and young men went off to fight, technically trained women were in demand. In 1942, Ross went to work for Lockheed Aircraft. She helped design the P-38 Lightning, an innovative, fast, and powerful fighter that made its mark in both the European and Pacific theaters. After the war, many women engineers were laid off to make room for the men returning home.
But Lockheed kept Ross on the job, even sending her to UCLA for her professional certification in engineering, the first Native American woman to earn that credential. Ross was one of the early members of Lockheed's famed Skunk Works, the top-secret advanced development division that worked on cutting-edge, breakthrough aerospace technology. She was the only woman and the only Native American at the Skunk Works. Much of her work still can't be discussed publicly.
If so much of her work had not been classified, she would have won a Nobel Prize. Mm-hmm. That's how innovative, that's how important the work that she did was.
Some of the work that is public now includes the Polaris submarine launch missile and the Agena rocket, which carried numerous satellites into Earth orbit. Ross also contributed to NASA's Interplanetary Flight Book, which detailed spacecraft flight plans to Mars and Venus.
What she really wanted to do was be the woman behind the first woman in space, and she did that.
After Ross retired from Lockheed in 1973, she devoted the rest of her life to encouraging young women and Native Americans to pursue careers in science, engineering, and math. Ross died in 2008, 3 months shy of her 100th birthday. In 2019, the U.S. Mint honored Ross by putting her image on a Sacagawea $1 coin. And we've got an update for you before we go. That Israeli-linked tanker we told you had been seized in the Gulf of Aden off Yemen has now told a U.S. Navy vessel that it is safe and free. That's according to two U.S. officials who spoke to Reuters. And that is PBS News Weekend for this Sunday. I'm John Yang. For all of my colleagues, thanks for joining us. Have a good week.